But you can see here my computer crashed.
Yeah, I can see it. It crashed. Yeah, it needs to restart.
It was good you were able to log on to Zoom with your phone. Maybe after like 20 minutes, I would have given up on you. Like, yeah, like, he's not coming back.
What should I say?
He's tired of hearing about qualitative methods. No, he's not coming back.
Did I offend him? Oh my goodness.
Yeah, like, well, that was too much.
Welcome to this episode of the Academy Management Review Origin Series. My name is Rich McAdock. I'm the host, and today I will be interviewing Professor Stina Grodel from Northeastern University about her co-authored paper titled Achieving Rigor in Qualitative Analysis, the Role of Active Categorization in Theory Building, which she co-authored with Michelle Entebbe and Audrey Holm. Welcome. Thank you for joining us, Stina.
Well, thank you for having me.
Good, good. So I like to start these interviews by asking for just what is your brief 1 minute or 2 minute elevator pitch explanation of the paper? Tell us a little bit about it.
So this is a methods paper. And so it's meant for anybody who'd like to do qualitative research. And the thing we advocate in the paper is that really when we do qualitative research, it's an active process of theory building.
Nice. Okay. Do you want to give any more details about it?
Yeah. So we draw on categorization theory to kind of show how really when we do qualitative analysis, it's basically a categorization process. And so as scholars, we actually engage in a lot of active moves in order to try to categorize our data in various ways. And that is very important that scholars are very reflective and transparent about that active process through which they analyze their data, because that is the way that we're going to achieve rigor in qualitative research.
Very interesting. So just purely coincidental that the last episode of this interview series was about a paper that is intended to help make quantitative research studies more reliable, and yours is intended to make qualitative research studies more reliable. I wish I could say that I had planned that, but I did not. So it just works out very coincidentally. So who are the target audiences for this paper? Who should be reading this?
It's really meant for anybody who would want to do qualitative research. So that can be both seasoned scholars, but of course we are intended in more towards junior scholars or people who are trying to learn how to do qualitative analysis. So in that way, the intention of the paper is really to try to help people who would like to embark on doing qualitative research and try to make their qualitative research more rigorous, to show them a path, at least some tools that they can use in order to make qualitative research more rigorous and thus also achieve more and better theory building. Because at the end of the day, that is also the goal of qualitative research, is to build better and stronger theories.
Right. So tell me a little bit about how this project, this particular paper got started in the first place. Where did you or your co-authors get the idea for this paper from?
Yeah, so so the story is this, that Michelle at the time was an editor at Organization Science, and so he received a lot of manuscripts. And he had come to the realization that many people needed a little more guidance on how to do qualitative research. And I had been working with a lot of PhD students, And also been given seminars, meeting with a lot of PhD students also at other institutions, and realized that there were a lot of people that struggled with how to go about doing qualitative analysis, and that many people got lost in this process of doing qualitative analysis. And so the story is this, that one day, turns out that Michelle and I, we both live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, even though we were both at Boston University at the time, but we also then both lived in Cambridge. And one day I was walking down Massachusetts Avenue, and there was Michelle in the street in front of his dry cleaners. And then we stopped and we started chatting, and he was telling me about how, you know, it could sometimes be frustrating to be an editor at an organization of science, because he felt that he received all these manuscripts that he felt were not building theory rigorously enough from their data. And I began to talk about how I've been thinking about this problem too, talking with a lot of scholars, and in particular that I had been thinking about the fact that a lot of people got lost in the fact that a lot of think qualitative methods courses emphasizes this need to merge codes, to develop a lot of codes and then to merge them together to these overarching constructs. And the kind of idea being that somehow theory is going to emerge out of this kind of merging process. At least that was how it was interpreted by a lot of students. And I'd just been to a conference where I tried to talk with a student about this. And so he and I are talking about this back and forth and thinking about there's really a need here. But then we didn't really do anything about it until Audrey came. And so Audrey was Michelle's student at the time. And she was also struggling with this fact that she had been open coding her data, and she had 100 different codes, and she felt she wasn't going anywhere. And Michelle had said to her, maybe, you know, you should have lunch with Stina. And so we went out for sushi and we were talking about this coding process, and it kind of dawned on me more and more that there was kind of like a problem here to be solved. And, you know, and then I said, you know what, Michelle and I had thought about writing this method paper, and, you know, this really crystallizes it for me that there is a need here. Maybe the three of us should get together and kind of think about, you know, how can we help people do better qualitative research. And that's really kind of how the paper started. And then with the three of us got together, and we got very excited about this kind of idea about using categorization theory to maybe help people think more clearly about how to do qualitative research. And yeah, so that was the original story. And then, you know, the three of us just also had a lot of fun, and we all grew in the process. And I think that's the kind of the beauty, you know, of working with co-authors and with students in particular, right? They ask great questions, like Audrey came with a lot of great questions, and also sometimes kind of asked a lot of questions where I realized I took a lot of things for granted. But because we had Audrey on the team, she was really able to kind of push Michelle and I out of our kind of comfort zone to begin to also articulate some things that we sometimes had been thinking about but that we took for granted in a lot of our own work when we were doing qualitative research. So I just think we all brought something to the table in that process. And really that is, I think I personally love working with co-authors, because they always push you, you learn from them. You know, Audrey had also just been taking a lot of methods classes, so everything was fresh to her, right? She'd just been reading Blaise and Strauss, and right? I mean, for us, for the rest of us, for me and Michelle, it was like years in the past, right? And mm-hmm. and so together as a team, we really made this paper happen, I think.
Yeah, so it sounds like a lot of fun. I would say probably any paper that involves meals at a sushi restaurant, I'm sure, is going to be a lot of fun. I have so many questions. I'm not sure which order to ask them in. So you talked a little bit about the kind of conventional wisdom, and, you know, not being a qualitative researcher myself, I'm not that familiar with this, but you talked about the conventional wisdom being that you start off with low level codes and then aggregate them into more superordinate categories and all that, and then hope somehow that a theory emerges from those broader categories. So tell us a little bit about, you know, how does that work? Is that an effective method? Was it ineffective? Did the challenges of using that method help to motivate this paper? Does your paper suggest abandoning that method or modifying it or what? Just tell us a little bit about how that conventional wisdom relates.
I want to say that I think that the conventional wisdom is actually to do something like we advocate in the paper, which we also show and demonstrate by drawing on the wealth of scholarship where people have suggested a lot of different moves that people take. So in that sense, we are kind of standing on the shoulders of giants and bringing together some things that other people have said in the past. I think that just that some people, students in particular, have kind of interpreted when they read about grounded theory and open coding, they get the impression that they need to open code every single line of text in their transcripts. And this is completely overwhelming, right? I mean, I've had meetings with students where they said, like, we've been coding and coding and coding for like 3 months, and we have like 300 codes, and we're more confused now than we were at the beginning. And I'm like, I get it. I feel confused just talking to you about it, And so I think that, and one of the things that we also advocate in the paper is this idea of starting with a puzzle, right? I mean, and so the first step in qualitative research is not open coding. The first step in qualitative research is puzzlement. Mm-hmm. You need to be puzzled about something. And then to say, how do I get puzzled about something? Well, you read through your transcripts. You know, you read through your transcript, you read through your field note, or you read through your archival data. You immerse yourself in an understanding of the whole phenomenon at a kind of more macro level before you begin this minute and detailed process of open coding. So before you begin microcoding, you're really kind of developing a sense of your whole data and what it is you're puzzled about, you know? And I think that this puzzlement and this, you know, is something that people need to bring to the table. This is also what we call the active categorization process, mm-hmm. that we also come to the data with our theories and our understanding that makes us puzzled about something. It's not just kind of an emerging process. No, you know, we get puzzled about something because it violates some of the expectations that our mm-hmm. theoretical frameworks would tell us should operate in this particular location, right? You know, so, and as qualitative researchers, we need to not diminish, but activate that kind of sense of curiosity and puzzlement. Because if, you know, if you're not puzzled about something, then there is maybe no, it's more difficult at least to develop a theory there, right? Often when we're puzzled, it's because there's some kind of something that's not right, right? Something mm-hmm. that is inexplicable from our existing theoretical framework, right? It's not as we expected it to be. And we need, that's the nugget, right? That's the nugget. That's the beginning of a great paper, right? The beginning of a great paper is this puzzlement. And when you first have this puzzlement, something you're interested in, you can begin to ask questions, right? You begin asking questions like, why? What is it? What's going on here? What's happening, right? Like, why is this kind of unusual, unfamiliar, weird thing happening in my data, right? And you begin to ask these questions of your data. You know, what's going on here? And when you do that, you take a path through your data. This is also something I think is very important, is that people think that there's like one story in all of your data. Mm-hmm. No, there is an infinite amount of stories and ways in which you could explain your data. And as theory builders, we take one path through the data. And maybe another time we'll take another path and write a different paper. Right? In any given data set, there are many different stories to tell. There's many different theories to build, right? The same as there is in a quantitative data set. Just think about all the papers that have been written on the patent data set, right? Mm-hmm. Millions of great papers published on one data set. And the same is true for qualitative data, right? That depending on what you're interested in, you will write a different paper. because you will build theory around that specific construct that you are interested in. And so in order not to get overwhelmed with data and overwhelmed with construct, which is, I think, the greatest problem that people have when they do qualitative research, they get confused, right, and overwhelmed. There, it is very important to just go into the data with this puzzlement and these few questions, right? And just let yourself say, this is the one question I'm trying to answer right now. I don't have to tell the whole story in my data. The same way as when we do a quantitative analysis of the patent data set, we don't have to tell every single story that is being told to us through the patent data set, right? We tell one story. And the same goes for qualitative data. We tell this one story that answers this one theoretical question and puzzlement that we have. So I think that is just very important. And we need to go through those steps of puzzlements and asking questions before we can go into the kind of more minute, you know, data and analytical process of merging codes, you know, splitting codes, comparing codes, all of these processes that then come after puzzlement and questions. So, I mean, that is at least one big takeaway that I hope that people will have from the paper. Right. And I hope that will help some people not face this feeling of being overwhelmed.
Right. So I like this aspect of the paper when I was reading it, that, and I don't know if you would use the word subjective. I don't think you used that word in the paper, but you make the point that different people with different questions will have different puzzles and therefore will categorize differently, right? You, for example, gave the example of how pieces of furniture would be categorized differently by an antique dealer than they would be by a moving company or something like that, right? Or by a homeowner. And you know, the antique dealer might categorize you know, tables and chairs and dressers in the same category if they come from the same century, right? They might categorize furniture by century rather than by function. Whereas, you know, a homeowner might categorize them by room or by function. So there is an inevitably subjective element to your categories that's dependent upon your purpose for categorizing in the first place. Is that a fair representation of what
I like the word purpose and goal better than subjective, because subjective sounds like it's random. Right, you know, you know, so that it's random or kind of non-rigorous, right? Where I think that the thing to take away is that depends on your purpose, right? I mean, going back to the patent data set, if you have a quantitative data set, you know, you, depending on the question that you ask of the data, you'll get a different answer, right? I mean, you might choose one dependent variable or another dependent variable, a different independent variable, and that will be a very different paper depending on what you're interested in, right? Are you interested in performance? Are you interested in innovation, right? Are you interested in the industry life cycle, right? I mean, there can be a lot of things you're interested in a quantitative data set. And the same goes for qualitative data, right? That depending on what our question is, we will be able to build a different theory around that. Right. And so I see that more as kind of the fact that we enter into the data with a purpose and with a goal in mind to answer a specific question. And so that question, you know, will be answered, you know, will look different. And I think the reason that when people say, oh, you know, we cannot compare this and that, people will read these transcripts in many different ways. Yes, of course, you know, because I mean, depending on you, I mean, I might be interested in this industry life cycle, and you know, you might be interested in managerial responses, and we're going to then ask different questions of the data, and that will going to provide us with very different answers, right? You know, and so that's why it's kind of important what our goal is and what question we're going to answer. What are we interested in when we go in to look at the data, and you know, that doesn't, I think that actually, when we are more explicit, and this is a point we make in the paper as well, right? When we're more explicit and reflective about that, it actually becomes our work becomes more rigorous because it becomes transparent. It becomes transparent that, okay, I went into this setting because I was interested in helping behavior. And so I asked questions of the data around helping behavior. And so I wrote a paper on helping behavior. But maybe you are not interested in helping behavior. You are instead interested in coordination, right? And so you're going to ask questions of the data that answer the questions around coordination, right? And so we can write many different papers depending on the questions that we have. And I think it has a lot of similarities also with quantitative data, because you will also ask a lot of different questions of your data set, right? Depending on what your interests are, right? We can, coming back to the patent data set, right? You know, I don't know how many millions of papers are written on that patent data set. Right?
Yeah. Or the Alliance data sets.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah.
So you mentioned a moment ago, you mentioned transparency and rigor in the same breath. And I noticed that you did that in the paper, in the abstract, you say, our framework emphasizes that if we are not sufficiently reflexive and explicit about the active analytical processes that generate theoretical insights, then we cannot be transparent and thus rigorous about how we analyze data. So I wanted to follow up with you about that, because one thing I noticed was that you use the word rigor and rigorous very frequently in the paper. I counted there were 35 uses of the word rigor and 9 uses of the word rigorous. So 44 altogether. And I noticed that you don't really define the term rigor or rigorous in the paper, or at least I didn't see it defined anywhere. So I wanted to kind of follow up with that. What do you mean by rigor or rigorous when you use this term? And how does it differ from transparent? Because I get that transparency is, as you just said a moment ago, and as it says here in the abstract, transparency is kind of a prerequisite for rigor. But I get the sense that you're distinguishing rigor from transparency in some other way. And I'd like to better understand what that is.
Well, I think the two are very closely linked, that through transparency, we achieve rigor. Because rigor is really, to me, an ability for other people to understand what it is that you have done, right? To be able to kind of follow you through your research process and have an understanding of how did you come from your data to your theory building. And transparency is the method through which we achieve that then, because by being transparent, we are guiding the reader through what did I do? Why did I make this choice? You know, why did I end up with these informants? How did I then end up asking these kind of questions? Why did I select on these particular constructs that were interesting to me, to analyze and to look at? And so that the reader is able to follow you through your whole research process, to me, is what constitutes a rigorous paper. And there we are saying we thus need to be more transparent in the way that we actually describe our research process, and we need to be more articulate about a lot of things that are taken for granted. In the way that we do things and the way that we do qualitative research, because as all other research, most of the things that we do are actually not described in our method sections. And of course, we cannot describe every single step that we took in qualitative, not in quantitative research. We cannot kind of describe every single thing we did, right? We need to provide some overall a roadmap for the most important decisions that we took throughout our data analysis process, the things that really kind of made us do kind of a sharp turn or eliminate some data or focus on some other data, some of those, you know, big turning points that we make throughout the data analysis process in pursuit of our question and our puzzlement, right? In pursuit of the answer to that, and where we are trying to figure out, how can this be? What is my answer to this puzzle that is driving me, right? And so we need to just tell the reader about all those, the big kind of goalposts where we made a turn. And when the reader is able to follow us through in that process so that they have an understanding of the different decisions that were made throughout the research process, that is when we are tree breaker.
Okay. I think, you know, as I was reading it, I imagine that some readers would interpret rigor as having other connotations as well, such as, for example, that something that's done rigorously is done systematically and maybe uniformly, consistently. So is there an element of consistency or uniformity or or anything like that that you see as being part of the rigor that you're aiming for here?
I do think that being systematic is a cornerstone of qualitative research as well. To cite my mentor and a friend and colleague, Siobhan O'Mahony, she would say to the students, and I even wrote it down on a piece of paper and put it on my wall, that says, it doesn't matter what you do as long as it's systematic. So I this is also a foundational idea I have, and I think it's very important in qualitative research to approach your data systematically. However, I think there's a big however there, that there is also a fallacy in thinking that because you have used a template for doing something that you become rigorous, because you might have become the opposite, because you lose transparency. That what often happens when we report our data, and I think this happens in qualitative and in quantitative research, we begin to replicate the things that we think others want us to report. So we report the things that people are expecting us to report. That means we begin to follow a template that we kind of fill out in our methods section. And often that actually leads to a kind of a retrospective reconstruction of our research process that was not the way it was carried out. So because people expect that, for example, I merged codes and I found some overarching constructs, I'm going to tell you about that because that is, I know what you expect of me in order to be rigorous, right? And so I think it's a big fallacy to believe that because we have a template for something that seems kind of standardized and thus seems as though there's some kind of it's more systematic, that we thus have rigor. I think it's a big fallacy, right? It's actually the opposite. We lose rigor because we lose transparency. Because what people end up doing is reporting in the methods section things that they didn't do or only quasi did, or they are, and they end up omitting a lot of the goalposts where they actually took a very sharp turn because it wasn't part of the template, right? And this has many problems. You know, I actually think this has led to a lot of problems in qualitative research as such, because first of all, you lose transparency. You know, how did you actually come from your data to your theory, right? It becomes unclear. Second of all, it's problematic for young scholars who are trying to learn how to do qualitative research, because they look at your description in your method section and they believe that's what you did, but it wasn't, right? You were just reproducing and kind of institutionalized understanding of what a method section ought to look like, right? And that gives the wrong view of the research process and actually thus how you got from data to theory, right? And so I think that is kind of the fallacy that is easy to fall into, right? So yes, I think it's important to be systematic in the sense of approaching your data with a kind of systematic frame of mind to look at patterns, you know, patterns that occur in your data, to systematically analyze, you know, what happens in different situations versus other situations, right? So yes, it's important to have this kind of systematic approach to your data, but that's very different than following a kind of very systematic or standardized template in the reporting of your data.
Fair enough. Yeah, I think that makes sense to me. One other connotation I think some readers might think the word rigor has is reproducibility. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that, or, you know, maybe if you took a different researcher who was similarly trained and had the same research question in mind, the same purpose, the same goal, and put them in place of the researcher who did the study, that they would collect the same data, analyze it the same way, and reach the same conclusions. Is that kind of reproducibility implicit in what you mean by rigor, or is that something different?
I do think that situation in qualitative research is very difficult to achieve, right? Because think about it, right? And if you begin to hold qualitative research to the standard of reproducibility, I also think that you lose the goal of qualitative data analysis, which is theory building. And you build a theory, that is your goal. And the problem becomes with the reproducibility of qualitative research is that there's so many decisions that are made, right? And you know, you can think about it in terms of there being so many uncertainties and places where you had to say, oh, this was my goal at this point in time, and this was my goal at this point in time, right? If we were able to write a very, very long and detailed method section, I do think that we would be able to achieve that kind of reproducibility. But again, it would necessitate a very deep engagement between the researcher who had done the study first and the one who done it second. Again, because also with qualitative research, you are often dealing with data that is first of its kind, right? It's completely new, it's completely novel. It's not in a structured form, right? And so for example, if you do a quantitative study, there will be a lot of times when you do something and it's based on a convention and an institutionalized understanding, and that makes the reproduction and much easier, right? Because you're following this kind of routinized understanding of how do you deal with this particular variable, because we've seen this one variable before, right? We've been trained in how to address this particular variable and what to do about it throughout our studies, right? In qualitative research, we go into kind of green fields, right? Where things are really novel. We collect data about really novel phenomena, right? And so you make a lot of decisions that, you know, are one of its kind, where we are not drawing on this routinized institutionalized knowledge to the same extent as you are when you do quantitative research, right? And so this means that the reproduction of the theory from one person to another becomes much more difficult, right? Mm-hmm. Again, not because that theory was wrong, but just because they end up answering the different questions, you know? So the two researchers, the chances that they'll end up actually addressing the same puzzle and answering the same question is very unlikely, because they're not drawing on all of these kind of routinized and institutionalized understandings of how to analyze a particular kind of data set, as you, for example, are in quantitative research, right? And so this facet, this novelty, the multiplicity of qualitative research makes it a very kind of different beast. And I think it's a fallacy again, right? If you begin to think about it, right? You know, it's kind of like chaos theory, right? You know, the butterfly who flaps its wings, that sure, true, there's some kind of causal relationship between the beginning and the end point, right? And that doesn't mean that, you know, we're not talking about the laws of nature here, right? It's just because there were so many causal relationships that were involved that it becomes, you're not able to describe it, right? And so I think that this is where qualitative research is fundamentally different than quantitative research, right? It's because of the novelty and the complexity and the ambiguity that's involved. And I think, but it becomes a fallacy to say this thing that it's subjective, right? Or that it's not rigorous, or that then this theory has no meaning. I think that also comes when you look at the importance that qualitative research has had in the field of management,
right,
which is undeniable. That when you actually come, when you look at it, that a lot of the papers that are the most cited in our fields are qualitative research. The ones that have been voted to have the most impact in the field are qualitative research. And the, I think that the reason for that is that as qualitative researcher, we try to go out and try to look at something that is novel and something people haven't looked at before. And at least ask the question, could this be true? Right? Mm-hmm. This is also where there is qualitative different, quantitative research is different, right? Because qualitative research is at its heart about hypothesis generation, mm-hmm. and quantitative research is about hypothesis testing. And we need both. If you think about our methods of science, right? I think in our field today, there's a lot of focus on how do we test theories? How do we test hypotheses?
Right.
How do we do causal identification, right? And it's important. It is important, and I completely agree. But you also have to think about the other arrow that goes the other way. When we have falsified our hypotheses, how do we then develop our new hypothesis that will allow us to test something new, right? And that's where qualitative research comes into the picture in order to generate those theories. And and that's hard, you know? People, it's kind of like in a lot of, the way I feel that methods is taught in our field, it's as though coming up with the hypotheses is easy. But, you know, my stance is actually coming up with that new hypothesis is actually really hard, because you have to kind of break with your institutionalized understanding of what's going on in this field, right? I mean, for example, I have a paper on helping behavior. And you know, we were out in the field, we were collecting ethnographic data, looking at people helping each other. And in the beginning, when we were trying to analyze our data, we found it very difficult because most of the literature on helping behavior has kind of advocated that there's a help seeker and a help giver. And we're looking at this data and we're trying to figure out who's the help giver and who's the help seeker. And we're often confused about who is actually seeking the help here. It was clear there was helping behavior, but we couldn't figure out where the beginning and the end was it. And sometimes they were in groups, and how did that fit in? I mean, who, when people are in a group and they ask a question and they get help, who's the help giver and who was the help seeker? And after we for a while had struggled with this and tried to fit our data into the theory, we realized the theory was wrong, right? That actually many times in real organizations, help seeking and help giving behavior does not happen in dyads, happens mm-hmm. in groups. And it happens kind of distributed over times in what we call helping change, you know, A helping B helping C helping D, which kind of completely went against, you know, this whole huge literature on help giving and help seeking behaviors that have been construed as dyads. And so it's just an example of how, you know, you can say, well, is it, you know, This is about developing a hypothesis. You know, we then put out that, well, there's this hypothesis. We have that often help giving and help seeking behavior happens, you know, in groups and in chains and not in dyads, right? And then other people can take that and go out and test it and, you know, figure out how does this actually affect helping behavior much more. In a kind of much more kind of rigorous way where we can kind of causal identification and know about the relationship between our variables. And I just think that is really important to kind of keep in mind when you think about qualitative research is the goal we have, right? And the goal is this hypothesis generation, it's theory generation. And from that theory, we can go out and try to test our causal relationships.
Nice. So I wanted to ask about, you know, the goal of categorization, right? Mm-hmm. So let me play devil's advocate here. I'll ask a question that you know, will be intentionally provocative because I know that you have a good answer for it. Because I saw the answer in the paper, so I know you have a good answer for this. You know, as researchers, when we're categorizing, if the goal is that we wind up with kind of the right, or maybe I'm not quite sure how to phrase it, the right categories or the most effective categories and the most useful categories, however you define it, if that's our goal, what does it matter how we got there? Why does it matter how we got to that set of categories?
Well, that really matters for the transparency and rigor of our studies, right? And so it in a sense, it doesn't matter for the theory, but it does matter for the reader's appreciation and their understanding and the validity and the trust that they have into those categories, right? And so that's why we need to be very aware of the way that we actually categorize so that we're able to report that back to the reader of our papers, and in that way inform them and take them with us on the journey that we were on from we started data collecting to we build our theory. Because if they don't understand our categorization process, they will not really understand how we actually got to our theory, and thus they might not believe us, right? And so we want our reader to believe us, to have faith in what we did, right? Because I think at the end of the day, none of us will be able to say, okay, I've really proven that this is what I did, right? You know, and this goes for quantitative and for qualitative research, right? That we need to make a convincing argument, make our reader believe us, you know, show the evidence that makes them believe that, you know, you can trust me, you can trust what I did here. I lay out all of my cards and you can follow my thought process. And this is why I make a left turn here. And this is why I made a right turn here. And this is why I asked this question at this point in time. This is why I merged my categories here. This is why I split my other categories there. And by following in my footsteps, you will believe me because you have been on the journey with me in my methods section to from where I started to where I ended up.
So I think your answer to that question finally helps me understand what you mean by rigor. But you don't mean systematic, uniform, standardized. You don't mean reproducible, but you do mean credible.
Yes.
Right? So your use of the word rigor is what I would probably use the word credibility, mm-hmm. if I were writing about this rather than rigor. But that's just me. So now I think I understand where you're coming from with what rigor means, and that's good. That makes a lot more sense to me now. So I also wanted to just point out that you know, this is a paper about researchers developing category schemes. Mm-hmm. And the centerpiece of this paper is itself a category scheme. And so I wanted to, it's a category scheme about the moves that researchers use to develop category schemes. So you have a category scheme about the moves that researchers use to develop category schemes. Okay, so let me take it to the next level of self-referentiality, I guess. So can you apply your framework to your paper here? Can you tell me about what moves that you and Michelle and Audrey made in order to develop your taxonomy of moves?
Yeah, you know, I think that there was I think that it does apply. And you know, like we've been laughing a lot. I'm glad you kind of picked up on the kind of the irony of the paper being self-referential, because in the research team, we've had a lot of kind of jokes about that and the self-referentiality and are we categorizing here and which move are we making now? And these kind of things, you know, we had a really good time writing the paper. Yes, so I think the initial puzzlement, right? I mean, my own initial puzzlement was, I can exactly remember the time. I was at this conference at Harvard and a professor was talking about her student. She had done this Joya model where instead of merging all the constructs, she split the constructs. So they went from few to many. And the professor was like, I don't know what to do about it because it's so unconventional. And that just really stuck with me because I was kind of puzzled about, you know, about this student presenting this data table, because I felt like that should be totally fine. And that is when it dawned on me that it's totally fine because in categorization theory, we know we go from concepts from few, we both go from few concepts to many and from many to few in the process of developing categories. right? And so this was the moment in which I began to be puzzled about how do we develop actually categories from our data and begin to kind of think about the relationship between qualitative data analysis and qualitative data analysis and categorization theory, that the two might actually be intertwined. And so then it started out, right? You know, like with this relationship between merging and splitting, and I was at least goes both ways. Sometimes you merge, you split, you know, it's a process, right? And I was trying to discuss this with Michelle, who wasn't so kind of versed in categorization theory, right? But he's like, oh, it's totally right. But you know, Steven, that's not the only thing that's going on, right? You know, so we're asking questions of the data. He was saying, you know, there's a lot of things that happens, right? I mean, for example, this thing about being puzzled and asking questions, right? I mean, that goes on as well. And so we were kind of asking questions of this, being puzzled and asking questions of this phenomenon, right? And then over time, we began to grow our different moves that we were thinking about, right? And then we were kind of merging them and splitting them, right? You know, some of the moves we were thinking about, we realized, oh, they're actually the same, and that some of them were actually different, right? I mean, we put in the thing about dropping categories and dropping moves as something we actually realized is very important, something we haven't talked about that actually think is very important. I talked about a little bit in the beginning about taking your path through the data, but it's also very important about all the things we don't do, right? You know, building a good theory is also about all the theories you don't build, right? You know, so you you need to focus, and you need to only focus on a few things, because one paper is 40 pages and you can only talk about one phenomenon. And then, you know, it's lucky if you have a lot of other codes and a lot of other ideas and constructs and categories, right? There's many papers to be written out of your data. And so kind of dropping was also something that, you know, we developed later on in the process. So we really went through this. This process that we describe about puzzlement, asking questions, merging, you know, splitting, relating, figuring out how things are related to one another, right? And developing our kind of also theoretical stance and the hypotheses that we had about what is this all about, right? You know, and we began to ask these questions also on a macro level. What does this tell us more at a bigger level about what is qualitative research actually about, right? You know, what is at the heart? Why do we believe this is so important? And then over time, we develop this stance of saying, well, what we are arguing here is actually that this idea about the active categorization, that we as researchers need to be much more explicit and reflective about these moves that you take and the decisions that we make throughout different points in time, and that this is not doesn't make our research unrigorous. On the contrary, you know, the more that we can guide the readers through the paper, the more rigorous we become, and we need to be explicit about all of those things.
How did the project develop from the original idea, you know, at the sushi restaurant or at the dry cleaner, to the manuscript that you submitted? How did the project develop there?
Yeah, so it started out in the beginning, we were just kind of brainstorming the different moves that we were making when we were analyzing data. And so it really started with the moves and the idea about categorization theory. We went kind of back and forth. This is also where Audrey played a really big role in going back and reading through a lot of methods papers and a lot of methods books about what have been actually written about qualitative methods. And so we kind of iterated between these ideas coming out of categorization theory and these suggestions that have made within the existing literature. And so there was really this iterative process going on at this time. But at the same time, we were also thinking about what does this really tell us at a more kind of macro level and a more kind of theoretical level about qualitative research as such. And this is when we begin to develop this, this notion of the active categorization process. And I actually think that's kind of an important way of developing theory, that you constantly need to ask yourself about what does this tell me, right? What does this really tell us at a larger level about, in this case, methods, but in most of the papers that are in AMR, right? You'd ask questions about what does this really tell us about organizations, or what does this tell us about markets, or what does this tell us about the way people behave within organizations? This is what we call this kind of generating hypotheses, right? Where you're constantly trying to ask yourself, how does this matter at a bigger level for the bigger picture? Right? Because that's where the theory gets developed. If you keep staying at the kind of more micro level and you're just analyzing and categorizing and you're splitting your categories, you're merging your categories, you will never develop theory, because mm-hmm. the theory is about the interrelationship between all of those categories that you develop, right? The theory is not just about one category or one categorization process. It's about the interrelationships between them. And you get to that by asking these kind of macro level questions about where is this taking us? What does this actually tell me about, in our case, about methods, right? What does this actually tell us about the way we should conduct qualitative scholarship?
Nice. What were the biggest challenges that you faced in doing this project, and how did you overcome those challenges?
The biggest challenges, maybe some of the biggest challenges is that, well, you know, Michelle and I and Audrey all did qualitative research in different ways, right? You know, so there were some, I think, healthy back and forth, right, between us in terms of what do we think is important in qualitative research? How do we actually conduct it? What are the different moves that you make? To which extent should it be structured versus non-structured, right? Things like myself, I love visuals, right? And so I created a lot of visuals. Michelle, you know, was not as fond of all the visuals as I was, right? And so I had to argue for the visuals, but at the end of the day, you know, some other people read the manuscripts and they weren't as taken by the visuals as I was. And so, you know, I wasn't happy. I let them go, because you also have to kill your darling. This is a kind of key question, key kind of advice I give to people too when they do any kind of research, is like, kill your darling. You can't get too vested into any single ideal element of your paper, right? If people tell you that it's not flying, then, you know, you got to listen, right? And then carry sure. on the thing that you really enjoy.
So, sure.
I mean, that was, you know, yeah, then, you know, that was a challenge. But in general, this was actually a very easy paper to write, you know, and a very fun paper to write in general. So I felt our editor was always very supportive of the paper, and it wasn't one of those papers that we all have written, right? That go through years and years and years, right? I mean, from beginning to publication, it was a fairly swift process.
Mm. So tell us a little bit about that, that tells us a little bit about the process that it was, in terms of the editor was supportive and the process went quickly. Mm-hmm. But tell us how the paper changed through mm-hmm. the process, through the review process. Now, obviously, as you said, some figures got dropped, but what else about the paper may have changed in the process of the review?
Mm-hmm. Through the review process, the paper became much stronger in terms of its, I think, the front end of the paper around what was really the contribution to qualitative research. In the beginning, the first draft of the paper kind of laid out this relationship between categorization theory and qualitative research, but it wasn't as clear about how did this actually make research more rigorous. And it also mm-hmm. didn't have this element of the active categorization process that, you know, was very few snippets here and there, but it wasn't the strong kind of positioning of the paper as it is in the published version. So that was where we got a lot of really helpful feedback from our editor and from the reviewers, where they liked the kind of middle part of the paper around the different moves, but they had a lot of questions about why it mattered. You know, like, why is this important? You know, what is really at a kind of bigger picture level, why is this important for the way that we do qualitative research? And so I think that really strengthened the paper. I think this always happened in the review process. Papers just get better, right? It gets better when people ask you challenging questions that get you to perform better, to be more specific about your ideas, to talk within the, you know, co-author team about what are we actually doing. And so I think that both the reviewers and the editor really helped us kind of make the paper much stronger and make a much stronger contribution with the paper.
Right. So just as one closing question, what impact, what long-term impact do you hope that this paper will have in the future? I mean, if we look back 10, 15, 20 years from now, what would you like to, what do you hope people will say, you know, that the world is different today because of this paper in this way, right? What the world is different in this way because this paper was published 20 years ago or whatever. What would you fill in the blank there with?
I think that there's a bigger plurality of the way that we represent qualitative methods in papers. So the idea that people are much more true to their data process, right? And this leads to a greater plurality in the way that we represent our process. Because if you have to be rigorous, you need to be transparent about your process, but that process is unique to any mm-hmm. given, you know, data analysis process, right? And actually, so in that sense, I hope that our method sections are going to show a greater degree of plurality, but they're going to be closer to the actual research process that took place in order for the researchers to get from the data to their theory. And in that way, we can much better understand what they actually did. So that is what I hope that will happen. And thus also through that, we will also develop better theories. Because I also think that when we become reflexive about our process, it's also easier for us to question our process and to improve upon our process, right? If we are not able to at least describe our process, we cannot be critical towards it. And we mm-hmm. cannot ask questions about why are we doing that? And how does that actually lead us to our theory building? So I think in that sense, right, better methods also leads to better theory. And thus, I also hope that this paper can make just kind of a small contribution to us actually developing stronger and better theories.
Right. So I imagine that there could be some hurdles to achieving that impact in the mm-hmm. long-term future, right? For that to happen, you know, authors have to change the way that they write their method sections, right? Reviewers have to be open to these different ways of writing method sections, and editors as well. Editors have to be willing to accept papers with methods described in these ways. And also, you know, training has to change, right? You have to change the way you train doctoral students in mm-hmm. doing qualitative methods. I'm not sure what there's a question coming out of this, but maybe how can you get over those hurdles? What plan can help you get through those hurdles so that this paper really fulfills its promise in the long term in terms of having that impact?
Mm-hmm. I mean, from my own perspective, I've actually, since we wrote this paper, I've been very active in giving talks and talking to people about methods, trying to do podcasts about methods, trying to kind of convince people that this is an important discussion that we need to have, right? Because I think you're right that there are institutionalized norms for how you represent your data, and that it's difficult to change people's beliefs about what a rigorous method section is supposed to look like. So in that sense, I think that there is a lot of work to be done, and hopefully people will be willing and open to have that conversation and that debate about what should qualitative research look like? I mean, I do think that there is a larger community, not just on my co-author team, but a larger sense within the qualitative community, that this is a discussion that we need to have, and that we need to embrace the plurality that is kind of at the core of our method. I think that our method is one of uniqueness, right? We are a field of scholars that go into these unique and novel settings. And our methods need to reflect that. We cannot believe that we can, on the one hand, go into settings, collect data that is novel and different and varied in multiple ways, and apply a kind of very standardized lens to all of those particular settings. In order to develop the best theories, we need to adapt our methods to the problem at hand, to the puzzle at hand, right? This is something I encourage people to do as well, that, you know, you people ask me, you know, what data should I collect? Well, it depends on your problem, right? You know, what's your puzzle? And you start with the puzzle and you start with a little data set, and then, you know, you build elements like a house, right, of data that kind of helps you address the problem that you have in different ways. And that might lead you to develop kinds of data that other people haven't done before, right? But that's exciting, right? I mean, that's an exciting thing to do. And this is where we move our field forward. This is where we move management theory forward. It's also when we open up our minds and begin to imagine new types of data that we collect and new ways of analyzing that particular data. You know, and I feel in particular us as a community of qualitative scholars, that is the role we play within the kind of larger ecosystem of management scholarships, where we provide a lot of new theories and new ideas and new hypotheses and to the greater community. And so we need to embrace that, the plurality of our methods and the plurality of our research phenomenons, instead of trying to kind of restrain ourselves and become more like quantitative scholars. It's a fallacy, right? It's a fallacy to think that that is the way forward.
Right. Well, and very sincerely, truly, very much hope that this particular interview will be a first step toward overcoming all of those hurdles. That if we can get this interview to be widely viewed among the researchers who need to hear this message, that maybe that can help jumpstart the process. You know, and I definitely think that there's some great value in spreading that message. And I encourage you to continue to pursue it and to, you know, push forward with overcoming those hurdles. And I think, you know, my one little piece of advice would be maybe emphasize that you mean by rigor, you mean credibility.
Yeah.
Rather than those other possible meanings of the word rigor. You know, I kind of wish that the paper was called Building Credibility in Qualitative Analysis rather than achieving rigor in qualitative analysis, then I think the goal might have been just a little bit clearer. But nevertheless, I think it's a great paper, long overdue, very welcome, and it should provide a huge benefit to the global community of qualitative researchers, both in management and in other social science fields as well. So
I hope so. You know, I hope so. You know, that's, I've a humble approach to everything. And so as long as some people find it beneficial, I'll be happy. But definitely something, working on this paper has spurred my interest in methods. All of a sudden, I become much more reflective myself, you know, about methods, also other kinds of methods that, that I use and apply. And I think that having that reflexivity is beneficial for all scholars, right? You know, I think it's very easy to take some of our methods for granted. And a lot of the things we do become very easily institutionalized and routinized. And it's good once in a while to question yourself and say, you know, why are we actually doing this? Yes, it's kind of the thing we do, right? But why, and is it always beneficial, or are there actually some things that are missing here?
Great. Well, thank you again very, very much for joining this episode of the Origins series. Really appreciate it.
Well, happy to be here.